With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
One of the reasons we think we're these selfish and greedy people is that a very high proportion of those who govern us are psychologically atypical. I mean, broadly speaking, we're a society of altruists governed by psychopaths.
Welcome to the Doctor's Kitchen podcast with me, Dr. Rupi, where we discuss food, lifestyle, medicine, and how to improve your health today. The title is Creating Accidental Activists to Improve Health in a Post-Pandemic World. Now, that might sound confusing, but bear with me. You'll learn a lot more about accidental activism in this podcast episode. As we witness an improvement in the crisis, dare I say, and anticipate the relaxation of social distancing, I wanted to talk about the opportunities to learn and to reform our political systems that globally have revealed themselves to be woefully unprepared and slow to respond. Now, instead of pointing the finger after the fact, I actually think we should use this as an opportunity to try and recuperate the losses both emotionally, physically, and financially by trying to cultivate the opinions of thinkers from around the world who have long documented the unfolding crises in society that have now spectacularly revealed themselves to us. George Monbiot doesn't really need an introduction. He's an author, a Guardian columnist, an environmental campaigner. His books include Feral, Rewilding the Land, Sea, and Human Life, and Out of the Wreckage, A New Politics for an Age of Crisis, which is his latest book and something that was written 3 years ago, but I can't think of any other book that has really touched me in this way for a long time. It is definitely a book I would recommend reading, particularly right now, because I think it poses a lot of opportunity to rethink the narrative around our political landscape and what we can do to change our lives going forward post-pandemic. On this podcast, we talk about a whole bunch of different subjects: how to harness intrinsic human values of kindness to foster well-being in society, how the evolution of humans would have required community and kindness to survive rather than the prevailing narrative of individualism and inequality. We do talk about politics and neoliberalism, and I don't regard myself as someone who's politically motivated or interested in politics, but this podcast actually made me realize just how politically active I am, and perhaps not in the sense that I thought I was before. We do address alienation, loneliness, which I think are the defining conditions of our time, as well as the rise of social initiatives and accidental activism. What I think is an opportunity to build a different economy and big organization in the wake of the pandemic. And big organization, we go into that in the podcast, and you'll learn a lot more about how collective action can yield huge, huge benefits to us. I really hope you enjoy this conversation. It's a little bit different from what I'm used to doing, but I think it's definitely going to touch a nerve with you listeners who have followed me for a long time now, and I think it's a really important discussion to be had right now as well. So if you want to learn more about my guests, please do check out thedoctorskitchen.com/podcasts. Check out his social links and the links to the book and all his articles that are on his website, monbiot.com, and sign up to the newsletter whilst you're there as well, where we share recipes, lifestyle tips, and how to help you live healthier, happier lives. On to the podcast. Before we start, I just thought maybe it'd be best for you to introduce yourself. My podcast is largely about wellness, how to eat for health, and a whole bunch of topics. But we're really expanding the topic base because I think it's never been a more important time to think about systems change and how that has an impact on healthcare, which you go through in your book as well. So if I could ask you to introduce yourself to the audience, that'd be great.
I'm George Monbiot. I'm a writer, journalist, activist, professional troublemaker, write about all sorts of things, mostly with an environmental slant, but a lot of social and political stuff too.
And your book, which is hopefully going to be the focus of our conversation, but I'm sure we're going to digress. You wrote this a couple of years ago, Out of the Wreckage. What was the impetus for the book and what kind of spurred you on to go in this kind of direction? Because a lot of your work, I think, has spanned around, you know, environmentalism, but you've done investigative journalism at the start of your career too.
Yeah, so I'd written a book before, or it was a collection of essays called How Did We Get Into This Mess? And a lot of people in reading it said, okay, you've shown us how we got into this mess, now how are we going to get out of it? So so really that was the impetus that, you know, and I had to sort of answer the question. But also I've become very interested in sort of breaking out of the standard political box. You know, we see politics in very narrow terms in this country, generally in party terms. You know, you're either Labour or Conservative, or you might possibly be Lib Dem or Green or Brexit or something, but you're defined by your party, and it's very much controlled from the centre. Here's the party structure, hoping to get into government, hoping to run the nation from the centre. And my feeling is, well, it's just not where people are at all. The great majority of people, you know, we don't want to be part of that incredibly simplified and top-down system. When you look at how people organize themselves, and boy, have we been seeing that during the pandemic, you know, this incredible flowering of mutual aid as people help each other get through this difficult time, you'll see that, you know, we're not just sitting there passively waiting for someone to tell us from on high what we ought to be doing and how we should be living our lives. And we can create a lot of the solutions ourselves. And my feeling is that what we urgently need in this country and elsewhere is a hybrid system where we need the representative politics, because, you know, you do need government to run an NHS and to run pandemic responses and lots of other things like that that only governments really can do. But you also need much more participatory democracy, much more bottom-up, grassroots, deliberative democracy, where we can sit down together and solve our common problems. And it's sort of exploring that hybrid system and exploring how you can bring community together, make much richer community, and use that community as a seedbed for a new politics to grow, a politics built by the people, for the people, rather than this top-down, simplified thing controlled from the centre.
I'll be honest, my personal perspective as I've grown up, or particularly over the last 10 years, is that I've been quite passive about politics. And I think that's reflected by quite a few of my colleagues as well, i.e. it's too far removed from me. My vote doesn't have or carry that much weight. And I'm sort of apathetic to any changes that I could be a party of when it comes to the political sphere. I've done some stuff within my locus of control, so trying to reform medical education to include nutrition and lifestyle medicine, which is one of the most powerful tools that we have. But when it comes to politics and fundamental changes that have an impact on a healthcare system, I felt quite removed from it, if I'm honest. What do you say to that sort of like apathetic response, or, you know, people who become apolitical?
I'd say, isn't it interesting how you put those in two different boxes? You know, you've done all that great work on nutrition and stuff, you know, which has been really positive work, which is political. You know, you're trying to create change among people. That's political. You know, all politics is relations between people. And you're trying to change those relations in a very positive way. And then you say, but I'm not into politics. And that's exactly the problem. That's exactly where we are, that we have this thing called politics, which is over there. It's not in our lives. It's somebody else is doing that stuff, and they're doing it to us. You know, it's something which, well, you know, we might decide to participate in a sort of little way, but running around stuffing envelopes for the party or voting every 5 years. But it's basically this thing being dumped on us from above. Whereas what the first thing you were talking about, that is also politics. In fact, that to me is the lifeblood of politics, is people taking action to improve stuff, even if it doesn't go through political parties. And the fundamental problem I think we've got here is that society is this incredibly complex system. I mean, fantastically complex. Even one person is an incredibly complex system. You know, our physiology, as you well know, is highly complex. Our brains are highly complex. We behave in all sorts of unpredictable ways because we have these emergent and adaptive characteristics which complex systems have. Put two people together and you square the complexity. You put 65 million people together and you've got this phenomenally complex system. I mean, staggeringly, incomprehensibly complex system. But they try to govern us as if it is a simple system, as if you can say, right, here is a diktat which we as a legislature are going to pass down and we're going to make you do this, or we're going to respond to what we think the public will is and translate it into legislation this way. And it's this really crude, brutal, simplified way of handling a phenomenally complex society. Now, I happen to think that complexity is a good thing, and that the great diversity of people's engagement with each other, engagement with the systems that surround them, that's a really good thing, which we should be building on and working with and allowing to flourish and allowing its unpredictable, emergent, adaptive characteristics to come to the fore in lots of good serendipitous ways, which they do when you let them, as we've been finding during the pandemic, with all these incredible social movements just emerging apparently out of nowhere, but actually emerging out of the community spirit that has long been there, but bubbling under the surface. And so the politics we need is a politics that says to you, what you are doing is political. What you are doing is crucial to shaping the nature of this country. And it should be embedded in a network where all those actions are recognized as being political, and where we can all participate as equals in producing this better nation that we want. And that's where we can bring together the sort of actions that you and your colleagues have been taking, which we could broadly describe, I think, as community action in one way or another, with a community politics, which means a participatory politics, a deliberative politics, where we're sitting down, we're talking to each other, and then we're passing decisions up. We're sort of devolving them upwards, where we could almost say, right, the primary unit of political decision making is the local community, and we devolve decisions upwards towards bigger and bigger political units, but basically they're ultimately responsible to us, ultimately responsible to that local primary unit. And I think that would much better reflect the complexities and diversities and wonderful abundance of our social lives.
Yeah, it's interesting you say that, because I think it's the, and you talk about this at the start of the book, it's the narrative that we allow ourselves to believe, or the dominant narrative that something is outside of our control and we don't have any influence over it. Whereas if you put it in terms of, okay, what kind of things can you get involved at a local level or a systems level within your specialty or within your field or within your industry, you know, it kind of politicizes that way. It kind of makes you understand just how much impact a single person or a group of people can have. And I suppose, how can we change that narrative, apart from obviously, you know, listening to things that you do and getting involved in social initiatives? How do we actually change the narrative that actually empowers people and makes them realize just how much control that we can have?
Well, I'm really glad you introduced the issue of narrative, because recognizing the importance of narrative in politics is almost half the battle. It's like, because the person who tells the story, or the movement, the group that tells the story, that captures other people's imagination, is the one that becomes a sort of sweeping force in politics. And if we don't tell a good story, someone else is going to tell a good story, and it might not be the story that is going to be useful to us. So if we look at the whole history of politics, and indeed of religion, going back thousands of years, the movements that have succeeded are the ones that have a new narrative to tell. But it's a particular kind of narrative. What's very interesting to me about this is that when you look at the narratives which have worked, even if they are completely different in terms of where they're trying to take us and what they want you to do, whether it's a sort of ultra-capitalist one or a communist one or a religious narrative or an atheist narrative, they all have basically the same narrative structure. Now, you probably heard the debate between how many basic plots there are. You know, some people say there's three, and some people say there's five, and some seven, and some nine. It's always an odd number for some reason. But, you know, there's meant to be a certain number of basic plots. And I think, you know, we can agree there are common narrative structures which are used again and again, where you get lots of different books and films and stories, all using a basic structure, even if they are used to tell completely different stories. And the one which seems to work always in religion and politics is the restoration story. It's a narrative structure which goes as follows. It says, the land has been thrown into disorder by powerful and nefarious forces working against the interests of humanity, but the hero or heroes confront those powerful and nefarious forces, against the odds, overthrow them and restore harmony to the land. And in its different forms, that restoration story has been told again and again and again, whether it's been told, for instance, in the Christian religion or the Muslim religion, or been told by the Keynesians or the neoliberals or the Marxists or the Nazis or the Democrats or any movement at all which has succeeded in politics or religion, tells that story. And while it's a necessary condition, it might not be a sufficient one, but it has to be there. If you're going to succeed in politics, it seems that you can't get there unless you tell a convincing restoration narrative. And it's very interesting that people in the past seem to have been aware of this. So when laissez-faire economics completely fell apart with the Great Depression just under 100 years ago, causing appalling suffering and disruption, John Maynard Keynes sat down and he wrote his general theory, which is a very good restoration narrative. It basically says the land has been thrown into disorder, caused by the powerful and nefarious forces of laissez-faire politics, the economic elite basically grabbing all the money for themselves, destroying effective demand, ensuring that there's no circulation within the economy. But the heroes of the story, the working and middle classes, empowering a benign state, will, against the odds, overthrow those economic elites and restore harmony to the land in the form of money spent into the economy through public works, generating employment, which generates consumption, which generates growth. And it was a very powerful and effective restoration story. Now, some people absolutely hated the Keynesian story. People who could best be described as the neoliberals, who basically wanted to restore a kind of laissez-faire economics, but in this case, empowered by the state with sort of various new features. So people like Friedrich Hayek, Ludwig von Mises, later on Milton Friedman. And they sat down quite consciously and deliberately to write a restoration story of their own, which said that the land has been thrown into disorder by the powerful and nefarious forces of the overmighty state, which, by controlling our lives and taxing us and regulating us, crushes freedom, destroys human opportunity and potential. But the hero, the freedom-seeking entrepreneur, will confront that disorder, overthrow those powerful and nefarious forces against the odds and restore order to the land in the form of liberty and opportunity. That was their story. It was a very overt and deliberate restoration story. And when Keynesianism ran into trouble in the 1970s, they were able to step forward and say, here's a new story. And politicians eventually across the political spectrum said, oh, thank God, there's a new story. We'll latch on to this. This is a story. And then that completely and spectacularly fell apart in 2008. The whole neoliberal edifice just collapsed spectacularly. And so the opponents of neoliberalism came forward with nothing. We had no new story to tell. And so we had some people say, well, maybe we should go back to Keynesianism. And you just can't, you know, you can't go back in politics. You know, you don't inspire people by saying we'll just do what they did 50 years ago. That doesn't excite people. Also, you know, there's a fundamental flaw for the 21st century is that it depends on sustaining levels of consumption. Mm. And you know, those levels of consumption are destroying our life support systems. Mm. But other people said, well, maybe we should have a bit less neoliberalism, some neoliberalism light. Well, yeah, it's just that doesn't inspire people either. And that just creates an opening for neoliberalism to continue, which, of course, is what happened. And so we get stuck with the old discredited system, even when it's fallen apart, because there's no new story. So our job, really, part of our job, I feel, is to tell that new restoration story. Yeah. And I feel it is rooted in the sort of things that we're talking about. It's rooted in community. You know, it's you could tell it sort of roughly along these lines that, you know, the land has been thrown into disorder by the powerful and nefarious forces of neoliberalism, which by breaking society apart, atomizing and ruling, are saying, you know, you're all individuals. There's no such thing as community. And we're going to break apart the social fabric, privatize utilities, deregulate, destroy trade unions, destroy social action, to even say in Mrs. Thatcher's case there is no such thing as society. They have really sort of destroyed our capacity to solve our problems. But we, the community, the heroes of the story, by coming together and forming a grassroots solidarity, a sort of social insurgency of exactly the kind we're seeing during this pandemic, and building that into participatory politics, can, against the odds, overthrow those powerful and nefarious forces and restore harmony to the land. That's the basic idea.
I mean, it's really interesting. There's so many different things that really do resonate with me there and I want to touch on. But prior to the pandemic, I would have thought that the dominant theory is that the natural order of things is inequality. And that's borne out by perhaps the advent of social media, where we prize those, or we aspire to be like those who have the fame, who have the likes, who have the status in society. But now, I think, in a post-pandemic world, perhaps people will realign what our true values are and the values that actually benefit our overall well-being, not to mention our health as well. I mean, there's a lot of evidence that, you know, attachment and community and belonging and, you know, the opposite of alienation, which is the dominant illness of our society in the UK and the US as well, we've been suffering with. So now I think it's even more of an opportunity to really change that story that we tell ourselves in society and reestablish what our values should be.
Yeah, no, I think it is. I mean, it's, you know, it's a terrible crisis, and you will have seen the most appalling suffering. You know, we know that it's really, really hammering people, this, and it has exposed many of the weaknesses of the system that we're in. You know, a government which didn't want to govern, which was basically tearing itself apart, the self-hating state saying the state shouldn't exist, basically. And we suddenly discover, oh my God, we need the state. We desperately need the state. We need good government. We need competent government. We need people who actually care about others in government. You know, which that would be a nice thing, wouldn't it? To have empathetic people in government. Who don't just sort of dismiss it all as oh, well, you know, we get herd immunity, and if thousands of people die, yeah, if thousands of people die, they're going to die anyway, eventually. So what's the problem? Which has, unfortunately, you know, with some people really literally been the attitude. I mean, the most extreme case being Jair Bolsonaro in Brazil, who literally said, so what? when he was confronted with the numbers of dead. And you know, it's a peculiar, interesting thing that there's, as you probably know, there's a huge amount of psychological work, also in anthropology, in neuroscience, in evolutionary science, showing that the old story we tell ourselves, the sort of Hobbesian story that we're fundamentally selfish and greedy, we're all at war with each other, just doesn't stack up at all. And a lot of experimental work, masses of science on this, showing that, yeah, we've all got some selfishness and greed in us, but they are not our dominant values. Our dominant values are much more about togetherness, about cooperating, about creating a nice social setting for ourselves and those around us, working together, kindness to others, family, community. These are our dominant values. And we've been told a lie on this. I mean, a total lie about who we are. But one of the reasons we think we're these selfish and greedy people is that a very high proportion of those who govern us are psychologically atypical. I mean, broadly speaking, we're a society of altruists governed by psychopaths. And the question which keeps occurring to me is, why do we let this happen? Yeah. Why does this keep happening? You know, you look around the world and you'll just see a whole load of really damaged and strange and wholly atypical people governing nations full of great people with tremendous potential and intelligence and empathy and kindness towards others who could do so much better job than they're doing. Why do we let these buffoons constantly to govern us? And that's, you know, a big question we should all be asking ourselves at the moment.
It's interesting you say that, because I think that's essentially why people have an apathy towards the political system, quote unquote, because we are governed by people who don't have the same perhaps altruistic values that we share as a community. We're sold this idea that we are competitive and we should be individualistic, even though, and I see this from an evolutionary perspective, it would have been absolutely impossible for the human race to exist if we were of that mindset, because, you know, we're not incredible predators. We're not, you know, we don't have the attributes of a normal predator to survive in a wild environment. So we had to work together. And there's lots of neurobiological evidence to suggest that we work better when we have attachment, when we have connection, physical connection with our families and communities. So this, I think, this actually breeds a lot of apathy towards the political system, because when you look at your ballot list and you look through the names and you look at their backgrounds, you don't resonate with them at all. And this is something I think needs to change going forward, but I just don't know how. And I think a lot of people listening to this will echo that.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think it's partly that the system almost inevitably produces candidates like that. You know, for a start, in a lot of places, you need a lot of money if you're going to succeed, if you're going to get anywhere. And the people who are good at raising money are often the last possible people you would want representing you. Because either they're extremely rich already, or all their friends are extremely rich, or they're prepared to suck up to billionaires and corporations to get that money. And you think, no, that's exactly the opposite to who we need in charge. Because we need them, you know, representing the people, not the billionaires. And so that's part of it. It's also, you know, it is this remote system. A system that's remote from our lives, that's not on a day-to-day basis controlled by us, is a system which is very easy to take over, to capture by an elite of any kind. And it sort of is almost set up for ownership by elites. And so we end up alienated, not just from the individual characters, but, you know, from the whole setup, really. And when you look at how it could be done, like, for instance, the participatory budgeting that was done on a big scale for about 15 years in Porto Alegre in Brazil, or like the Better Reykjavik program in Iceland, or a very similar thing, Decide Madrid in Spain, where cities are basically run by the people. And with this really interesting, innovative, participatory ways of doing it, nowadays using new communications technologies, you know, which really lend themselves very well to grassroots democracy. You just ask yourself, why the hell does it still have to be like this? Why do we have this sort of cod medieval system in this country with all the sort of black rods and the sergeants at arms, you know, and all this stupidity, all these people wandering around in gaiters with sort of frilly ruffs and gold braid? It's like, this is ridiculous. This is, if you design something to be more alienating, you know, visually and in terms of its whole tenor and character, you could not do a better job than that. It says they exist in this bubble which is totally impenetrable to the normal person. You know, we can't even understand what the hell's going on, let alone we can't physically get there. You know, you're barred. I mean, you know, one of the main parliamentary buildings is even called Portcullis House. You know, a portcullis is what keeps you out, and it just, everything about it is wrong if you want buy-in, if you want people to actually feel this belongs to me, this is a system that I'm part of and that is part of me. And so, you know, I continue to think that we need representative democracy alongside participatory. I don't want a pure system of either kind. The representative side also needs massively to be reformed and changed. It needs to look like us, you know, to look like the diversity of society and the not just all the different peoples, but all the different ways of living and ways of being. It looks like nothing that the rest of us have anything to do with. I mean, it literally is a culture of its own, which looks as far removed from our lives as could possibly be, unless you're one of those people who do go around in fancy dress all the time with ruff and tights and gold braid, you know, carrying some massive fancy bit of gold hardware in your hand. It's so ridiculous. It makes me so angry. You just see this and you think, you know, you're saying it's tradition. You know, they say, oh, it's tradition. And you say, no, actually, that tradition has a purpose, which is to shut us out and to keep it within the sphere of the elites, to make sure that orbit is not something that we penetrate.
Yeah. And I see these sort of like, you know, I'm glad you used the word tradition there, because I think, you know, I see that on a micro level and a macro level. We see that within the healthcare system, we've always done this way, and this is why we do it, without really questioning why we do it that way. It's one of the reasons why we still use fax machines in the NHS, which is it drives me mad every time. And I work in like a very good trust, a very well-funded trust as well, that is averse to progress electronically that will have direct impact on patient care. And we see this every step of the way within the NHS. But one of the things I wanted to talk about, and it was important there, because you mentioned how the reason why we have these political figures that carry the same characteristics generation after generation is because they suck up, or they come from wealth, or you know, they have links with wealth. But what we saw in America with Bernie Sanders the first time around, anyway, was this concept of big organizing. And it's the first time I've actually heard of this, and it really got me excited, because I think what we could witness in a post-pandemic era is the realization that big organization can have an impact across different industries and beyond politics in the way we currently see politics right now.
Yeah, no, absolutely right. So big organizing is this idea that instead of professionalizing a political campaign, or indeed any sort of campaign or any sort of movement, where you have this sort of core of professionals who are going to do the job for you, and you hire them and you pay them to do it, you delegate the vast majority of tasks to volunteers, who then delegate to more volunteers and create these sort of traveling waves of activism and action. And basically you have this incredibly devolved system based on what the pioneers of it called radical trust. Mm. You know, the standard political model is you have this highly centralized political party which says, right, here's what we're going to do. We're going to micromanage everything down to the nearest detail. If you want to volunteer, you can stuff envelopes or you can knock on doors. That's it. Yeah. And people still volunteer because, you know, people really do believe in politics. They want democratic change, and that's a great thing. But it's very thin involvement. Yeah, it's quite insulting, really, to people's intelligence that this is all we're going to allow you to do. Whereas the Sanders campaign pioneered this thing, which was actually picked up by the Corbyn campaign also in 2017. And we saw two very near misses there, starting from a position of real disadvantage. They very nearly scraped in, both of them. It's all gone a bit wrong subsequently. But we saw those two campaigns using this extraordinary new method of basically saying, right, we're going to set the general tone and direction from the centre, but when instead of raising huge amounts of money and hiring a huge staff, we're going to do it all in a shoestring budget. We're going to delegate really important tasks to volunteers not being paid at all, to set up local networks, set up local meetings, set up the whole sort of phone banking idea, all of those sort of communications networks and stuff. And then they in turn delegate that to smaller, but local, more local bodies who in turn delegate it to others. People can then set up new parts of the system. And when it works incredibly well. This was also, incidentally, the model that Extinction Rebellion has used to great effect, very effectively indeed, in becoming this very powerful force very quickly indeed from a standing start. And in theory, at any rate, a sort of voluntary network like that can beat machine politics. It can beat billionaire politics, but they haven't quite got it right yet, or we haven't quite got it right yet. You know, it needs refining. The Sanders campaign very nearly got there. Part of the problem, and I think also with the Corbyn campaign, was that you had this sort of this real split between the traditionalists, the sort of, you know, traditional centrally organized socialist approach where this is the way we do it, this is the way we've always done it, not quite getting what the new people were doing, which is, you know, you get young, often very techie people saying, look, there's this great new app I've developed which can allow us to do this. I say, what's an app? You know, and so there's a real sort of cultural chasm within both of those campaigns. And, you know, it was bridged to an extent, but it wasn't as streamlined as it could have been. With Extinction Rebellion, we didn't see the cultural chasm. It was much more streamlined and you know, they really, really got big organizing. They really understood how it can work and pioneered new aspects of it. So it's very much a model in process, which, you know, it'll never be completed because society will never be completed. You just sort of keep experimenting, you keep pushing it forward. But I think it's got enormous potential and we're only just beginning to explore it.
Yeah. And hopefully that will, you know, this, if there is going to be a positive that to come out of this pandemic, will be a catalyst towards those ideas and actually how we can instigate social change, all these different initiatives. And I also wanted to touch on this concept of the donut economy, which I believe you borrowed from another book that you mentioned in the book you wrote. I've never come across that before, but it really did appeal to me because I think, you know, I've been sold this idea, and I think we've all been sold this idea, that for a society to function, we need to have a constant level of growth. And that doesn't really entertain the health of the environment, which therefore has a knock-on effect on the health of our society as well. So I wanted to ask you a little bit about what a donut economy is and how you think we could do this in a post-crisis or post-pandemic world.
Yeah. So this is the work of Kate Raworth, a fantastic economist, who has really sort of pioneered this idea of how to make sure that everyone's needs are met without bursting through planetary boundaries. And, you know, there has, I mean, in fairness, there's been quite a lot of work on this before, but she's pulled it together in a really beautiful way and in a visual way. The reason it's called donut economics is that she has a diagram, which is like an American donut with a hole in the middle. And the hole is the social floor through which we shouldn't fall. Set by the Sustainable Development Goals, you know, everyone should have good shelter, good food, good education, good healthcare, good sanitation, a good enough political power, good gender relations, you know, all of those basics of a good life, that no one should fall below that hole. And the outer ring of the donut is the planetary boundaries. How much greenhouse gases can we produce before we broach those boundaries? How much nitrogen can we use? How much biodiversity loss can the world stand? These things, which have been set by scientists as the sort of outer limits we shouldn't breach. And unfortunately, yeah, we're breaching them left, right and centre. And she's saying, right, let's imagine an economics which lives within, between those two boundaries. So between the inner ring and the outer ring, that's the safe space in which we should be living, where we can have, you know, human well-being within a thriving web of life. And then she tries to build an economics around that notion of that safe space. And I just think the way she's pulled it together and presented it is really compelling. And so do a lot of other people. There's a lot of cities now which are picking up donut economics. Amsterdam recently announced that after the pandemic, that's going to be its economic direction. And quite a few other cities around the world are now using it and developing it. So I think we'll see a lot more of it. And that's a really positive thing.
Yeah, I'm really excited to see, or hopeful that we can have like a new era of progressive politics that really does recognize those social values that I think a lot of people are recognizing themselves. And maybe some more accidental activists as well. I mean, I kind of regard myself after this conversation as an accidental activist without really realizing that I was instigating some change on perhaps a bigger level or inspiring other people. But, you know, with the rise of social initiatives and things that you mentioned in your book as well, I think, you know, people will realize that actually they have a lot of impetus and a lot of power. One thing I wanted to ask you about is how you're personally coping actually through this time period, and what is in your suite of self-care tools to help you get through this time?
Thank you, Rupi. Well, look, I'm massively luckier than most. I mean, I really am. You know, I've basically been self-isolating for 57 years. You know, I do my own thing. I work from home. Keep myself quite good company. Yeah. I'm very lucky in that we all really get on within my family, which also makes a huge difference. You know, I can't imagine what it would be like to be basically stuck indoors with people you don't get on with. We've got a small garden, which makes a difference. Most importantly for me at the moment, we've got an allotment, which years ago with friends we planted up with fruit trees. So we got like 40 mature fruit trees on this allotment, and getting down there to manage it, well, put it this way, it's going to be the best kept allotment in history by the time this lockdown is finished. But one of my allotment neighbors pointed out that actually working in an allotment is exercise, work and obtaining food. So it ticks all three of the boxes for why you're allowed out. So technically we could be there all day. So it's a bit of a lifeline for me. I'm finding the balancing difficult because I'm teaching because the schools are closed. I've got an 8-year-old. We locked down together with one of our neighbours, part of the whole community thing being developed around here. So from the very beginning, we said, right, we are an isolation unit, us two families, because their daughter is best friends with our daughter, and they would both go nuts, I think, without each other. But with each other, they're fine. That is really great. And we got four parents to teach them. So we can split it up a bit. One of them is a professional teacher, which helps enormously, but we can all bring in something different. And so I've been using the sort of version of the Finnish model, teaching ecology, sort of project-based learning, where you use it then, you use sort of ecological experiments and learning to go into maths, to go into science, into geography, into literacy, into all sorts of painting, all sorts of other areas. And that's been working reasonably well. I mean, it's challenging. What's challenging is sort of moving between being a parent and a teacher. And saying, right, I'm a teacher now, so you've got to listen to me like you listen to a teacher, and you can't cheat me like you would cheat me as a parent. And that that's a struggle, you know. And sometimes I get it right and sometimes I get it wrong. Obviously, I've got a huge amount to learn about how to teach, but, you know, it's an education for all of us. Yeah. So that's been good, mostly, frustrating occasionally. But at the same time, I'm researching a book, and part of what I wanted to do for the book is learning soil ecology. I mean, trying to get up pretty close to degree level on soil ecology. And it just happens that's the one kind of ecology you could do at home.
Yeah,
so you get more or less a complete picture in your own garden, or better still, in our allotment, because there you've got a nicely structured soil. And I've just been spending hours at a time with my head in a hole, basically.
Yeah, definitely.
And it is fascinating. I mean, it's really mind-blowing. I mean, the soil, it's like, you know, I thought, I've got to my age and never done this properly before, because once you're in it, it's like snorkeling. You're in this other world. It's completely other world. You know, you have to learn about what all the different soil organisms, soil animals and things are, learn what you're seeing. And as soon as you do, it's like, this is just unbelievable. This is fantastic. I mean, it's really, really mind-blowing. So, that's been a good project to do. I've been enjoying that.
I'm absolutely fascinated by that. I'm getting a couple of guests on to talk about regenerative farming, the importance of the biome of the soil, and I know a couple of colleagues that I perhaps should introduce you to as well that have been studying the ecology of the soil for their entire lives. So, and I think hopefully that permeates into mainstream discussion, because I think it's along with viral pandemics, the literal threat of microbial resistance that I think is going to be, and not to catastrophize, but I think it's going to be even worse over the next 5 to 10 years. And, you know, as someone who's witnessed over my relatively short medical career of just over 10 years, the progress by which we've started using third or fourth line antibiotics in my short, that's really scary when you put it like, when I was a junior doctor in 2009, we would have to call the microbiology consultant and have another consultant confirm that they were going to use this agent. Now it's become first line in some hospitals, which is really blows my mind. But the importance of the soil and how that provides nutrition to the plants, which therefore provides nutrition to us, that really needs a lot more attention. So I can't wait for that piece of work. I think that's very, very well worth it. And a lot of people will hopefully change their minds about the way they eat and see the environment in that respect.
Yeah. I mean, I'm very glad you raised the issue of antibiotic resistance, because it keeps me awake at night as well. And it is mind blowing. And 3/4 of the world's antibiotics are used on farms. Yeah. And most of them, not even to make animals better, but to stop them from getting ill. Used prophylactically, put in their feed, because when you cram so many animals together in a chicken farm or a pig farm or something, they're bound to get terrible plagues. And so it's just, this is total madness. This is squandering this precious resource. And as you say, it's just, you know, I mean, I've had 8 lots of procedures over the last 2 years because I had cancer, and then that was just got sorted out thanks to the NHS, wonderful, amazing people. But then I had complications arising from the operations. I had all sorts of stuff going on, and every time I had to take antibiotics. In total, in those 2 years, I've taken 13 courses of antibiotics. Mm-hmm. I would have died 13 times over, probably, or at least about 10 times over, if it weren't for those courses of antibiotics. And you know, as you know, you can't do surgery without antibiotics. You can't have chemotherapy without antibiotics. You can't have safe childbirth without antibiotics. And you know, we are totally stuffed if we lose our antibiotics. And yet it's like everything else, we're just squandering it, this amazing resource. Individually, we can be really intelligent, but when it comes to the systems under which we work, those systems are really stupid.
And so this again comes down to
the wrong people being in charge and setting up the wrong institutions for us to work through. Institutions which say, yeah, it's fine to just keep slapping antibiotics all over pigs.
Yeah.
And, you know, it really does speak to this sort of this perspective that I'm seeing a lot perpetuated on social media and by some prominent leaders as well, that this is the fault of a particular country, i.e. China, because they have had wet markets. And they promote, you know, the inappropriate collection of animals. We have to look at ourselves, because it could have quite easily come from any farming system across the industrialized nations. And we are going to be witnessing something in the next 10 years, by all the predictions that I've seen, that will stem from the lack of looking at ourselves and actually, you know, trying to practice best as we can ourselves before, like, you know, blaming others. And yeah, that's kind of worrying, and hopefully people realize that.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's fair to say that what's been going on in those wet markets is terrible. You know, it's just the wildlife trade has been devastating to wildlife. And of course, it's just a time bomb, you know, for you're bringing together species which would never otherwise have encountered each other. And there's bound to be transmission of disease. I mean, I first became aware of this over 30 years ago when I was working in the Amazon. And every so often there'd be a rabies outbreak, and large numbers of people would die of rabies because you were a long, long way from any nearest health center. And the reason this was happening was people were cutting down the forest, and the vampire bats, which up until then had been feeding on the sloths and monkeys in the forest canopy, would have no sloths and monkeys. They'd come down to earth and start feeding on the people instead. I mean, it was sinister. This was properly sinister. People were terrified. Because, you know, suddenly you just wake up with rabies, you know, and it was like, whoa, you know, horrifying. So, and so there is, you know, unquestionably, it's terrible. You know, what they're doing in the wet markets is terrible. But as you say, you know, we're in no position to point the finger to anyone else, because you just look at the average intensive pig farm or broiler chicken unit, you know, you just got a perfect reservoir for disease, as well as the most appalling cruelty on those animals, all crammed together with miserable and meaningless lives, just being fattened up as quickly as possible for slaughter.
Yeah. And on that positive note, I'm going to let you get back to teaching your children using project work. It's been fascinating chatting to you, George, honestly. And I really do commend you for your work and your continued activism, and you know, it's been amazing to chat to you, and I can't wait for the next book. I think it's going to be brilliant.
Thanks so much, Rupi. It's really lovely to talk, and look, really good luck with all you're doing. I massively admire the way you're sort of, you know, doing what, you know, the rest of us probably wouldn't have the courage to do in the NHS. So thank you, and keep up the great work.
Appreciate it, George. Thank you so much. I want to end this podcast with a question, and it's one that I pose myself as well. What are we going to reward in a post-pandemic era? Is it those with material wealth, the loudest voice, social influence, or is it those who seek to build community and foster relationships? And this isn't just in political spheres, it's within our own unique and direct communities. And this is an opportunity to build a future, I think, that we all want to be part of. And I would encourage you to read some more articles on the subject and see and what social initiatives you can be part of, because I think we can all be accidental activists, whether we like it or not. Please do check out monbio.com. There's a whole bunch of articles that George has eloquently written. Not a word is wasted. And I think he's one of the best writers of our time. His career that we didn't even get to explore covers undercover journalism, investigative journalism, as well as environmental activism. And he has a lot of opinions, I think, on the environment that I think are well worth listening to. And like I said, I can't wait for his next book as well. It's going to be definitely game-changing for a lot of people who aren't really considering the unfolding crises that are, and again, not to catastrophize, and that could yield even worse issues going forward. So on that positive note, I hope you enjoyed this podcast, and I will catch you next week.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers. With rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's Stamps.com. Code PROGRAM.